Welcome back. I'm Alfred Lambert Weber, and we have the extraordinary privilege today to be with Councillor Simon Parks, who's coming to us from the UK. Welcome, Simon.
Thank you very much. I'm delighted to be here with you.
The North American audience is really just becoming familiar with you, and I wondered, you're a town councillor in Whitby, and I wondered if you could explain to us what exactly a town councillor is, and what the duties are, and how you got to this position, and what exactly you do.
Okay, Alfred. I think you guys in the north of the states will understand the word city councillor.
Yes.
This is exactly the same as your city councillors. The difference is that because Britain's history is very long, we tend to make a difference between what we call a town and a city, which is based on the number of people that live there. So if it's below a certain level, it's a town. Therefore, if you are involved in politics and you're elected, then you're a town councillor. But if you live or serve in a town that's larger, you don't get the word city councillor, you get called borough councillor. It's very confusing. So let's just forget the names. Let's just think that I'm elected by the people, elected for a major political party, the Labour Party. This isn't the first time that I've served. I lived in London for a long time, and I served as a city councillor there in London, in the London borough of Hackney. And I'd left there, and I thought, right, what we say in England is I've worn the T-shirt. In other words, I've served in one of the toughest inner city areas in Britain, because, you know, phone's...
Sorry. Oh, my Lord. What am I supposed to do?
You're all right, Alfred. It's fine.
We're all human.
Some of us are, Alfred. Some of us are.
We'll get to that.
Yeah, right. London has a city of 8 million people, and having served an area of that, I dropped out of politics and just got on with my life. But the party that I served, I never left. And they were honoured me to get back involved. Now, what is important was that I went public with my story as to who I was, who my family were, and the alien experiences that I've had. But I did that before I was elected. I was absolutely determined that I wouldn't be elected and then tell people, because I could be accused of, you know, not being straight. So I went public, and the Huff Post did carry an article, so it did reach the states, very much so in my own country. And at that time, I was attacked. Very few people were supporting me. It was the whole media, the whole hounds, the pack just descended on me. But I was elected, and that's really important. The people of the town that I serve chose not to believe all the hype, and elected me. And that's put the establishment, the elite, in a very difficult position, because they can't turn around and say, you've tricked the people. So that was something. And the other thing is that you have a law in Great Britain which says that if you're insane, you can't be an elected representative of the people. Now, here I am. I'm in my third year of serving the people, so I'm obviously not insane. And I've got a reputation for being a very good councillor, to the point that I am now serving and chair a number of committees. The most powerful committee, I chair that. So it's very interesting that people who know me and work with me have a completely different picture from those people maybe in a big office block in an ivory tower who are the elite, who wish to try and discredit me. However, just to bring it round, Alfred, that I, and we may want to chat about this a bit later, it all turned about last year when the military, that's the British military, invited me to have a guided tour over their most secret base in Great Britain. Mm-hmm. And this completely confused all the media, who had been given a brief to make my life difficult. Suddenly, the Ministry of Defence, which is the British military, were inviting me for a three-hour tour around, actually it wasn't a British base, it's an American base, but it's called RAF Fylingdales. It's on British land, but it is really an American base. So it means the Americans had to approve this. So the British and the Americans approved it, and overnight the media changed towards me because they suddenly realized that there was something going on here. So much so that earlier this year, when the new Pope said that he was going to baptize aliens, at 6:30 in the morning, the BBC phoned me and said, "The Pope's just said he'll baptize aliens. We need a quote. You're the first person we've come to." So I've gone through a remarkable journey in a very short time, from going public, being ridiculed by the media or some of the media, to now a position where I'm the first person they come to for a quote. And that is actually, it's really remarkable that here I am serving as a politician elected by the people. Nobody's attempted to remove me. No criticism from my own party at all. And it's very confusing for people who've never had an alien experience, because how can this guy, me, Councillor Simon Parkes, be representing the people, be given three-hour tour over a secret base, and yet this is the guy that said that his mother worked for British security, his grandfather worked for British security, and he sees aliens. Something's not right here. So, Alfred, that's basically in a nutshell where we are at the moment, I think.
Right. Well, thank you. There were two reasons why I asked that question, and thank you for that very enlightening answer. One reason was this, and as a fellow municipal elected official, perhaps you can reassure this gentleman in Florida, who is the mayor of a fairly sizable city in Florida, a state in the U.S., who there's a program there to train first responders, firemen and policemen, for an ET sighting, and it's been being worked on with a grassroots citizens group. And they contacted myself and one other exopolitical person to serve as advisor to this. And when I went to do an interview on the program, which is it's been ongoing now, the mayor has refused to allow his city to be publicly named as part of this program. And I wondered since you're called on to comment, I said that I would provide the program with your comments so that we can take them to the mayor and begin to reassure him. And yourself, as a seasoned municipal councillor, both in London and now in Whitby, I wondered if you could address some words to this particular mayor. I can't say his name. I can't say the name of his city, but it would be...
I understand.
Yeah.
I understand.
It would be recognized, and just as a fellow municipal officer, that it's okay for him to say the name of the city, and for his officers, firemen and police, to be trained in extraterrestrial issues.
Okay. Well... Alfred, it may not be okay for him to say the name of the city, but it may be okay for him to undertake the training, because he will certainly have somebody higher than him leaning down on him. These would be my words to him, Alfred,
yeah.
That every city has to have a contingency plan for any eventuality. Mm. If we think back to the days of Orson Welles and the radio broadcast and the panic that the newspapers alleged took place, we can understand that the public need to feel secure that a plan is in place and that their elected officials have done everything that they can to provide that safety. If an elected official is approached by the public with a good idea, then it is another good idea to follow it. So if I was sitting next to the mayor and I had the opportunity to discuss the situation with him, then I would say that providing that the mayor put procedures in place that ensured that he was in control of the situation, I would recommend that he do it on a trial basis for a period of 3 months to see how that went, to see what reaction he had. And if that actually was positive, then he could then consider doing it on a permanent basis. So that would be my words to him.
Well, thank you. I'm sure that the citizens and the municipal officials who have worked very hard in this, as well as the mayor, will appreciate those words, and we will do our best. We will actually get this interview to him. Now, the second reason I asked you that question and was very intrigued by your answer, especially when you indicated that after the current Pope, Bergoglio, announced his intention to baptize extraterrestrials, they came to you for yes. comment. And I was going over your descriptions of your first encounters in 1971 with the very imposing insectoid being who came to be your more significant mother.
That's a very good way of putting it, Alfred. Well done. Well done.
And do you think that you, in fact, from that moment, or perhaps even before, have been groomed precisely for this role? That is, to be the go-to person, or a significant go-to person, for comment and explaining extraterrestrials to humans and humans to extraterrestrials, in the context of being an elected public official and therefore having some official stature?
It obviously has crossed my mind, Alfred. Just to say that the 1971 experience was not my first experience,
okay.
but it was the major experience of my life, although they have been ongoing. By the time of 1971, I was would have been just short of my 12th birthday. So I was reasonably confident with a range of non-human beings. The mantids, or mantis, as you guys call them, or manta, as they refer to in Australia, these beings have a very interesting role in the fourth dimension. And as you guys would have a football game, you have a referee. And my experience, my understanding of the creatures that I've associated with, is that they seem to have this role as arbiter. Not quite a referee, but an arbiter. They have a very long association with the Earth and with humankind, and they do meddle. There's no doubt about it. They meddle and they get involved, sometimes for good, sometimes not so good, depending on the situation and who you're dealing with. Nothing is chance, in my view. There was a long, drawn-out plan. I think that what you have suggested is one element of the unfolding plan that they had predicted a very long time ago. And I don't think it's coincidence that I'm still alive today and haven't been found in a ditch or dead in a car crash. So there are forces at play which balance out the great universe. It is without question the case that a number of people, either officially or unofficially, do come to me for some guidance. And that may well be preordained. However, I actually don't see that as my major role. But yes, I can't believe, if I look back on my life, that anything is coincidence, Alfred. I think it's all been planned. I have free will, but the route that I've gone down, I think, has been fairly well dictated.
Have you been shown scenes from your future life on any of your briefings on craft, or been told of scenes from your future life during any of these at all?
No, because that would affect free will. If I was to see a timeline of future, that may not even be the timeline that I choose to be on or we're on. And even if it was or wasn't, that would cloud my judgment, how I would interact and how I would act. So that's not been done deliberately for that reason. But what I have done is seen plenty of stuff from the past. The 1971 experience, quality researchers, refer to it as the time of the soul agreement. I made a soul agreement with a mantis. To me, as a 12-year-old boy, I didn't know what a soul agreement was, but I knew the word bargain. I had made a bargain with them, and I called it the bargain. And this was the bargain. The communication, which is never verbal, it's always from your mind to their mind and vice versa. It ran like this, Alfred. The offer I got was, would you like to be like us, to have power and knowledge, to see the future and know the past? So it was a deal, and I was so interested in about knowing about the past and, you know, being involved in the future, that I just immediately said yes. I was so excited that I didn't actually telepathically say yes. I verbally shouted yes. I was so excited with it. And then his hand, which had been on my shoulder, dropped down, took hold of my hand, and then said, come with me. And that then led on for two days of experience. So I'd made an agreement, but prior to that, in probably about 1965, I had made another agreement, in the sense that I had chosen which of the major races were to interact with me. I had the choice between the Draconis reptilian race and the mantis race. And I had to make a choice as to who I would have as my guardian, and I chose the mantis race. So although reptilian experiences have continued, the role of the two races in relation to me is very different.
Was it a question of inner knowing that led you to make that choice? Or?
That's a really good question, Alfred. I actually asked the mantis, after I had made the choice, I said to the mantis, did you know that I was going to choose you? And his reply to me was, if you have eyes to see, then you see. Which means basically that it was fairly obvious which way my soul choice was going, because I was more compassionate, and therefore I would want to choose the mantis race. If I was more violent or more aggressive or more adversarial, I would have chosen the reptilian side. I had both sides playing out from the moment of my birth to the moment of my choice, both sides showing me what they could offer, what their value-based system was. With the reptilians, it was very much, if you choose us, we will give you this, we will give you that. With the mantis, it was much more a spiritual choice. If you choose this path, this is where it will go. And I believe, fortunately, I chose to involve myself with the mantis, but not at the exclusion of the reptile race.
Sure. Now, just just following through on a detail, you mentioned that after the initial experience and the mantis being said, "Come with me," and you had 2 days of activities. Could you describe what those activities were? Or?
Some of them I can, some of them I won't, because they would be rather shocking for people who...
Oh, okay.
But I'm quite happy to talk about some of it. having agreed, I was taken on what looks like a moving escalator, though it doesn't work in the way that they do here. And then was taken to a room where there was a device which seemed to bathe me in light. I have no idea what that was. And then from there, taken to another room which was guarded by a reptile, a green-skinned reptile, but wearing a yellow tunic, a yellow uniform. And he was the keeper of the door. The reptiles are fantastic guards. They are amazing dark guards. And I sometimes am a little bit flippant, as we say in Britain. And if you had a... We call them a toilet here. I don't know what you call them in America. You call them a John?
Toilet.
Toilet will do. Well, if you had a reptile and you said to the reptile, "I want you to guard this toilet," that reptile would be incredibly proud that it had a job and it was guarding it and it had a very important role, and it would be, that's the happiest thing that it would ever want. So they are very, very determined when given a task, and guarding territory, guarding environments, guarding sacred objects, guarding ritual ceremonies is vitally important to them. So every door that has something important behind it on a craft that is shared will, in terms of racial groups who share these craft, it is the reptiles who will always be the police force, for want of a better word. So this guy was guarding the door, and the door was opened, and it was just absolutely lined with what I would now call hybrids, human-alien hybrids. At the time, I just call them little creatures. They weren't greys. They were definitely humanoid with lots of human expressions, and I went through this sort of pathway and then was faced with a tower, a very thin metal tower. I have no idea how high, 100 feet, 200 feet, I have no conception of that. And at the top of it, a dais, a flat circular platform, for want of a better word. And we got on a lifting device, rose up to it, and then I stood on this platform, and this is the very, very first time that I'd been there, and the mantis held my hand and raised my hand up in the air and said, "Raise your other hand." So I'll just do it now, Alfred. So hands up, not like surrendering, but right high, and every other creature down on the ground copied that. And I then felt a huge energetic thought wave of feeling, and the only way I can describe it is when you see on television a great big wave breaking on a beach. That's how it felt. They could see nothing. It was just this huge energy wave. And now, I've been up and down that tower many, many times, and that was the first time. So from that, a number of meetings with different creatures. I really can't describe them. And then what I would call a control room with 6 chairs in a circle, half circle, and a chair in the middle, and being asked by the reptile who guarded this particular room, would I like to sit in the big chair? And then I physically looked, didn't have to mind look, because when you're a child, you're still using physical actions and your mental actions. As you get older, you learn just to use your mental actions. So I physically looked and sent a message to the mantis, "What is this, okay?" And the mantis said, "If you wish to sit there, you can." I'm never told what to do, Alfred, but they will just suggest. So I sat in it, and I have never seen anything like it on this planet. It was on a metal arm, and it just extended, not like a hydraulic arm would extend, but imagine it just extended. So this metal arm just grew. Hard to describe it. It just literally grew and raised me up so that I was opposite a viewing screen. Not a window, it was definitely a viewing screen. And then over the course of maybe 40 minutes to an hour, a number of other creatures came in and took their positions in these chairs. And there were two tall greys at the front. These were the principal operators. That's the technical term for them in this particular scenario, principal operators. And then to either side of them, two small greys, and they were the secondary operators. And then on the viewing screen, I saw a whole range of images, which we don't have time for, but a whole massive range of stuff from past life experiences, which are relevant to me, mm-hmm. showing me personal history. Mm-hmm. I was told that I had to be programmed so that I could never be programmed by anybody or any other thing. Mm-hmm. And it was interesting because this year I met a qualified doctor who, not from Britain, but a qualified doctor who, quite independently of hearing what I've just said to me, you know what, you've been programmed so that you can never be programmed. And that's fascinating.
Yes.
And a lot of stuff took place which some people would find very difficult to cope with, very difficult to understand. And I don't talk about that unless the person is at a place in their development of understanding that it wouldn't shock them. However, I was then given tasks, and I could see how I was being trained for being a mantis. One of the tasks was, this is all hypothetical, I'm shown two races, they're at war with each other, they're fighting over a planet, and I have to find a solution to prevent these two races from fighting, because otherwise it will bring every other race in on a huge battle. And it's my job to go in and find a solution to prevent this. And I was set up a number of tasks, and each task I succeeded, because if I'd failed, I would have been out of their program. So there is an exam, in the sense that each task you're given has an outcome which has got a fail or a pass, and there's no in-between. You either fail it or you pass it. And recently, I saw a film called Ender's Game. It's only got a 12 certificate. My goodness me, when I saw that, and this little boy standing, I was sitting, but he's standing in a semicircular of chairs with his friends controlling the panels, and he is playing out a war game, and I thought, somebody knows something. And it was very interesting. When I did the research on it, I found that it is an official film for the Marines. Your American Marines actually have to watch it as part of their training. It's officially sanctioned for the Marines.
Is not a theatrical film we can go see.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. It's a theatrical film. It's out on Blu-ray, on DVD.
Oh, I see.
But it is approved as part of the curricula for the Marines in America to watch this, because it's considered important for them to watch it.
Oh,
and you can go to your store and you can get it. It's called Ender's Game.
Oh, very good.
So I saw that, and I know that a number of directors are in the know and they get stuff. So I saw that and I thought, hello, I'm not the only one. Somebody else is aware of what's going on. And at the end of that experience, I had passed whatever tests there were, and then I was returned back to Earth. And it's the only time that I can remember going back in my body, because I was taken as the energy signature. My physical body was left on the Earth, and I can remember I had to stand in a certain place on the ship to be returned, but I also had to stand in a set way. And then I can remember going back and being aware of my body actually on the ground, and thinking, I'm going to go into that. What's going to happen? Is there going to be a... And you get all scared because it's quite frightening. And then going into the body and this realization, I tell you what, in Britain we call it pins and needles. If you sit on your arm, sure, and it restricts the blood flow, well, when you rub it and it gets better, that's the feeling I got of that. And suddenly I was with five others. I wasn't on my own. There were five other young people with me. Suddenly the conversation all started up. It's just as if it had been slowed down and then sped up. So it's a fascinating experience, really, really fascinating. And as I walked back, I'd said to them, you know, well, what about the spaceship? And everybody said, what spaceship? It was a shooting star. It was a shooting star. And I said, no, the spaceship up there. And then, because there had been a school there, I haven't had time to talk to it, but there was a school. The first time I'd arrived on the spaceship, there was actually lots of human children and human teachers, and what you'd call a Nordic, who was in charge of the classroom. And I was greeted by a 12-year-old girl who said to me, I've been told to wait with you because they're going to collect you. You're not coming to school here. You're going up. That's what she said to me. And I said, as I was walking back on Earth with my friends, said, what about the school up there? And they just said, what school? So I knew then that I needed to keep my mouth shut, because it was causing aggravation. And it did cause aggravation, because one family was a Catholic family and they got very upset. The other family were a Greek family and they really got upset. But my mother said to me, draw it all down, what you can remember, and I'll show my friends. So she knew.
Yes, because for those who don't know, your mother had a special job. And what was that bad job at the time?
She worked for British Intelligence, which is locally known as MI5. She's British, so she was managed by British security, but she was told that she was working for the NSA, the National Security Agency, but she was handled on a day-to-day basis by the British Intelligence. But the work she was doing was being shared between London, MI5, and the National Security Agency of America. And what really stunned my mother was that we lived 50 miles from London. We didn't live in a big city, we lived in a town. And my mother had said, well, why can't you get someone else to do this? And they said, you are the only person in Britain who can do it. And my mother actually nearly fainted. She actually collapsed onto the sofa, the settee, because she suddenly realized that the weight on her shoulders, they had come to her, of all the people in Britain, they had chosen her to do that. And I think that was the beginning of her, because she had a breakdown, I think that was the beginning of realizing that there was a massive amount of expectation and weight on her shoulders. My grandfather also worked for British security, but the foreign base, which we call MI6. But hey-ho, he was working for the CIA. So he was born in Britain, but he used American words. And it was really, we say in Britain, bizarre. I don't know if you have that word in Canada or America, but bizarre, because in Britain we have the word trousers, but in America it's called pants. Mm-hmm. We have what we call a tap, and you call it a faucet. We have what we call a wardrobe, you call it a closet. And we have a car, we have a boot, you call it a hood and a trunk. Mm-hmm. And we don't have terms. But he used all these American words, mm-hmm. although he was born in Britain, because he'd spent so many years around the CIA, mm-hmm. he'd actually taken on these words. So my grandfather and my mother, for all intents and purposes, were working for the United States of America, for their own security part. So I didn't grow up in a military family. I grew up in what you'd call an espionage family, a spying family. And so, of course, I grew up knowing when to keep my mouth shut and to become a good judge of people as well, I think.
So that might account. This is a... Was that a parrot?
Well, it could have been, Alfred. It's actually a cat.
Oh, a cat!
But it's a... A Norwegian forest cat.
I see.
I have 9 cats here.
I see. Oh, good.
And it's just sleeping on top. They all like to be off the ground. But I'll introduce you a bit later.
Okay. Well, I was about to ask, perhaps the cat was saying, "Don't be absurd." But
it's because you used the word cat.
Oh, I see.
So it's activated.
Yeah, my cat was wandering around here earlier, so so perhaps that might account, I'm just saying, as a hypothesis,
uh-huh.
for why Ender's Game is on the U.S. Marine Corps list, because that would account for if your mother took the drawing, your drawing, and said showed it to her friends, it would have gone into NSA, and NSA is one of the conduits into Hollywood. So that would account for how that scene that you described for Ender's Game got to be. And since there's a sealed conduit there, it's valid intelligence, then it would have got the imprimatur to be in the U.S. Marine Corps. That's a hypothesis. I'm not asserting that that's the case, but I'm just putting it out there.
I think that you've done me a favor. I think that's something that I hadn't even considered. Thank you, Alfred. That's a very possible avenue. Very possible.
Thank you. Now, I'd like to kind of switch channels for a second to the realm of the soul.
Okay.
You describe that from the earliest moments, from very, very early, you have both the reptilian presence, the Dracos, and the mantid beings were sort of being around you, and this was building up to a choice.
Yes.
And it's at the soul level.
Yes.
And so there's something very special about your soul, are we all, do you have a special sort of soul? I mean, is it that we all have the same sort of souls, or are there, do mantids have certain types of souls? Do reptilians have certain types of soul? Do Homo sapiens like us have certain types of souls? Do yourself have a hybrid type of a soul? What is it about your soul that they must have pre-identified you so as to deploy, to use that word, all of this intention around you, do you think?
Okay. First of all, I'm not actually very important, Alfred. I'm just an ordinary person, and I just do what I need to do. So I'm just an ordinary guy.
Okay.
The soul... has a long history. The soul that inhabits my body has a very long history. But it's also about bloodlines. There are two things. There's the genetics in your body, which are bloodlines, because that's physical blood. And through my human father, that can be traced back to Mesopotamia, Persia, Sumeria, the kings of Sumeria. So my father's blood genetics has brought in the Mesopotamian line, Sumerian line, Persia. My father was Jewish. When my mother met him, she wanted to have a child. She didn't know why. She just knew she had to get pregnant by this guy. And he said, "You're not getting pregnant by me unless you convert and become a Jewess. But you don't have the cheap conversion. You have to go for the full conversion," which she did do. Because there are two conversions. The cheap one isn't recognized in the church, in any church, but the big one is. So she converted, and I was pregnant. She became pregnant. My mother's blood group, which at the time didn't mean anything to me, but I've now since learned is of interest. My mother's was rhesus negative, and my father was rhesus positive. And my mother said that at the time she couldn't have any more children because she was told that she would bleed to death. Back in the late 50s, there apparently weren't any injections or drugs that could prevent that. Now I understand that there are lots of procedures that would let someone of that blood group have more than one child. But at the time, she was told you can only have a one child, to which she replied, "I only ever want one anyway." She never remarried. She never even had another boyfriend. She said to me her sole job was to bring me up, to raise me. So my learning within a very safe environment over a long period of time I began to understand who I was from a physical perspective, but perhaps more importantly from a soul perspective. You asked lots of questions in one question, and we don't have the time to really do the justice to it, but I don't want to leave out anything, so I'm going to give a little bit of an answer to all your points. Mm-hmm. And if it really excites people, I can always come back and do another
okay. Okay.
My own soul is divided into three parts, one third mantid, one third reptilian, Draco reptilian, and one third hollow earth human. And I want people to understand that it's not, you can't draw a soul and then divide it equally into thirds. It isn't something that's been bolted on or welded on. It is one energetic field which has been created, and in that, depending on the balance, is how your body is. So, for instance, if I had more reptilian in me, I would have a much more reptilian features to my face. Although a third reptilian doesn't sound a lot, what people with a mixed soul tend to do is draw on the strengths of that soul at different times. So if I'm in the council chamber, it will be the mantid that is debating. If I want to look at a beautiful rainbow, look at something really lovely, then the human element will come out. If I need to get aggressive with another male, or there is something that's ceremonial or ritual, then the reptilian will come out. So it's about drawing on those parts. But any creature, any human-bodied person who has reptilian in them will have traits, mannerisms, likes. For instance, it was the Syrian race from Cyrus, who created the crystal skulls on Earth. So any indigo children or star children who are incarnating now on the Earth and are of Syrian extraction will collect little crystal skulls, which they buy from the gem store. And there are just so many links which someone like myself, who has connections with all these star families, and I don't need to read a book, I don't need to see a video, you just know it here. So I can look at somebody and I will know not just what soul grouping they are, but what percentage within themselves is that soul grouping. And I get people coming to me and they want to pay me, and I don't take money for it. And they say, can you tell me what my soul grouping is? Because for some people it's a real big issue. My own view is, if you're happy with what you are, then just accept who you are. So my soul can trace back through a gentleman called King Solomon. And that is why I have the association of the jinn around me. Psychic people who do Skype with me often see them behind me. People who visit the house will find them. For some people, it freaks them out. I never see them again. That's their choice. Jinn are not bad. It's what they're used for. So the jinn itself is like any creature. It's not a bad creature, but it's what magic has been used by a satanic black magician. That is the evil intent. So my soul has been around these creatures for such a long time, and they're part of my life. So it's a very old soul, and it goes even further back, but maybe that would be too much for your listeners to go any further back than that. So it is a soul with a lot of history on the earth. It's a soul that has associated with I say power, I don't like that word, but with office for making decisions, but always for the best of the people, hopefully. And so always in a male form, bar one. I've had one incarnation in a female form, but it's normally a male form. So humans can have a whole range of souls. You can have a human soul, earth human soul. You can have a higher human soul, Lyran, Palladian, Syrian. You can have an artificial intelligence soul. You can have a soul taken from a spaceship. You can literally have that. But if that is the case, your body will reject it. There are many human bodies on the planet now with artificial souls, and the body's falling apart because the body is saying, you're not an organic creation, therefore I don't want you. Hybrids have souls. tall greys have souls, reptiles have souls, mantids have souls. I tell you who doesn't, though, the little small greys, robotic greys, they don't need a soul. They don't need one. On a spaceship, say a small spaceship, like the spaceship that crashed at Roswell, the only creature with a soul in would have been the pilot of the spaceship. The others would have hive mind and wouldn't require a soul. If a soul has spent 1,000 years, 10,000, half a million years in a reptile, and you then took that soul out and put it in another body, it would reject it unless there was genetic alteration to the body. And this is what people don't understand. Aliens will come to a mother who has a growing fetus in her. They will take it out. Parents don't understand this. They take it out. They genetically add to it the particular race they wish to add to it. It's then put back into the mother's body, and it can either then be born naturally by the mother, or they can come back and take it away. But if it's to incarnate on the planet Earth in a family setting, it will be allowed to be born in a standard human way. But if you're going to put or you know that a soul is going to incarnate into a particular body, then you need to ensure that the genetics you've put in there will vibrate at the same rate as the soul, otherwise the body will just fall apart. And if you go to the Bible, Jesus made an allusion to this when he said that you don't put new wine into old wine sacks. So in other words, they had skins, wine skins, and if you had a wine skin that had lots and lots of very good quality old wine in it, you wouldn't then go and get a Beaujolais Nouveau, a new wine, because the skin would split. And people didn't understand. But what he's saying is, if you were to put a non-human soul directly into a human body, the human body couldn't cope with that. So what they have to do, and this is what this is all about when they take children out of the mother's womb and do stuff, is they are adding genetics so that the body can cope with the soul. And that's what that's about, Alfred.
Very interesting. You actually said something in that remarkable response that you just made that kind of jumped out at me, and that was that your soul has a history of leadership in office. Yes. And of course, number 10 Downing Street flashed up. And I mean, as a long established member of the Labour Party in a post 2017 environment, it is not inconceivable that you would be drafted. Has that thought ever
If I could serve the human race, I would serve them in any capacity I could for good. I have stood firm with my story, and no amount of trickery by people has caught me out or tripped me over. And when the curtain is raised, which I agree with you, Alfred, I'm planning on 2017 when the curtain is raised, people will need stability, and it's very important because there is going to be a vacuum in the power system on this planet for a short period of time, and that's when we have to be very careful, because other negative forces may well attempt to fill that vacuum. I would be more than happy to take a role if that is what humanity wanted. And I'm not talking about the elite. I'm talking about the ordinary men and women who felt that they'd been lied to by so many people, and therefore I'm hoping they will form a council. And exopolitics would be an important structure, because that is a structure that has a lot to it that I can actually identify with. And there would have to be a structure, there would have to be a range of people on that council, on that structure, who were not military people, who were not politicians who were just there to make lots of money for themselves. There would have to be people who had the goodness not just of the people on the planet, but their children, their grandchildren, and the future of the whole race. So, yeah, if that came to it, and somebody knocked on my door, and it was a genuine offer, I would say yes.
Very good. Could you share with our audience what you see may occur as of 2017, what the dynamics are, and some of your concerns and some of your positive visions?
Okay, well, the bottom line is it's positive. It's positive because on the 21st of December 2012, in excess of 3 million people who were critically awake at the crucial time pushed the planet forward. The CERN Hadron Collider failed to operate, therefore it couldn't counteract by jumping Earth into another timeline, because that was the whole object of the Hadron Collider. The CERN device was to put the Earth on another timeline. That failed to operate. What we're looking at is a very difficult 2 years ahead, a very difficult in the sense that there will be a lot of pain, which we have to go through. We have to go through because we cannot come out the other end unless we've experienced that. My hope is that as we move towards 1 minute to midnight, those people in high office will jump the ship and come and join people like me or people like you. And it's my belief that they should have an amnesty. That's my belief. By and large, there will be some people that you cannot forgive, but they are not likely to come and join the rest of us. They'll be the ones who will go into a deep underground bunker or get off planet or commit suicide. But I think that those people who are victims just as much as everybody else, and who suddenly wake up to the truth, if they have the courage to come over and say, this is the knowledge that I'm bringing to you guys, I think they should be welcomed and they should be forgiven for whatever they've done, because we need to forgive, we need to move forward. So I can foresee a very difficult 2 years, and then I can see a phase where the traditional structure systems of power that we know will just collapse. Not overnight, one tier will go, and then maybe 5-6 days later, another tier will go, and it will be like a domino effect falling down, and there will be a critical point when there is no government. Now, what happened in Iceland was the ordinary people went into the Icelandic parliament and physically threw their members of parliament out into the street. But that's never been reported, because the elite don't want that happening. It's going to happen. And people again don't know that the new constitution of Iceland, part of it was done on Facebook because they wanted to reach as many people as possible. Now the NSA is trying to get back in, and America's trying to get back into Iceland and take control of it. But the point I'm making is that when people are pushed to a certain point, they can find a voice. And as long as that voice is not too violent, it can actually bring forth something positive. And I think there will be a number of very key happenings in the next 2 years, which will make people realize that they've been lied to, not just on the alien, the ET situation, but on a whole range of situations. The public now are on the knife edge. They're almost ready to give up completely any trust they have in the present system. That's where they are now. And in the next 2 years, they will be desperately looking round for new leadership and a completely different style of government, a completely different style of way people are elected, and a completely different way of doing business. And that's what's going to happen. And organizations, individuals who have played a part in bringing this space to where we are now have got to be ready to get into there and take those positions, because what will happen is a key members of the military will say, right, we need a political structure. They will do that. They won't take power themselves. They will go for the civilians and say, we need a political structure. We're soldiers. We fight, but we need a political structure. And that is the vacuum which must be filled quickly. because if it isn't, external forces will attempt to come in and hijack the process. So it's positive. I'm not into fear. I'm not into doom and gloom. I don't believe in it. I don't buy into it. But there is a pain process, because unless we go through that process and learn as a race of people, we cannot come out the other end completed in our journey. And anybody who's alive on this planet now and stays alive at the end of the process is so lucky, because you have manifested by choice to play a role for good or ill in the final joining up of the circle that is this planet and what happens here. And finally, Alfred, whatever occurs on this planet will be a massive energetic ripple out through all the 12 soul families that are connected to humanity, but also beyond that, and there will be a very big beneficial effect, because the energetic shift here will actually raise up other races as well, who can benefit from that. So it's not just, we're not just battling for one planet here, we're battling for a massive, it cannot describe the effect that this will have throughout the whole multiverse. Phew, I'm going to have a rest now, Alfred.
Oh, that's wonderful. That's wonderful. You know, I can't resist because you toss out these things that are so amazing. What are the 12 soul families? I have never heard that phrase before.
Ah, these are the. It is wrong to assume that just the reptilians have interacted on planet Earth. Mm-hmm. Many other groups have added their genetics. All humans can trace a line back through to Lyra, to the Lyran Wars, when the reptiles forced the Lyrans to go all over the place. And these are the 12 soul groups that are incarnating at the moment on Earth. Mm-hmm. So they are making their claim, they're making a stake that as the Earth comes full circle in terms of the energy battle that we face, these soul groups will benefit from that, because they were in at the beginning, therefore they need to be on at the end. And when I say the end, I don't mean the end of times, I mean the end of this particular cycle. So the 12 soul families are the key alien races that have intermixed their genetics with humankind for thousands of years and consider themselves an integral part of humanity on this planet.
Right. Is there any way where we can access the list of those 12?
It's an incredibly difficult subject to talk publicly about, simply because the forthcoming battle on an energetic level will be around the 12 strands of DNA.
Oh, I see. Very interesting.
And the metanome, the metagene, which is the 13th strand of DNA, because there are people on the planet now who contain 12 strands of DNA, not physical strands, energetic strands, and the evil elite are going around the planet trying to kill these people or capture them or mind control them. The 13th strand is what's called the metagene. If you have 12 strands of DNA in you, Alfred, if you're active and you're communicating between your organic brain and your soul, you will be able to access these individual strands, but they're not working until the 13th is added, which binds them all together in one bundle.
Nice.
And that is the activation. And the other thing, while we're on that subject, it's a great shame to me that so much stuff has been demonized. You see all these rather stupid videos on YouTube showing people shape-shifting going into reptilian eyes, and it's shown as demonic. Even if it's just a camera glitch, it's made out to be very evil. I can shapeshift. It's perfectly normal if you have more than the standard two strands of DNA that you can shapeshift. And I'll explain the shapeshifting, what happens about a 1 millimeter above your face. The energy from your genes, if you can activate them, will appear. Right. And you can change the shape of your face. A lot of people can do it, and lots of other people could do it if their soul and their brains were communicating. It's not evil, it's actually what should happen. Because if you've had 12 different races interacting with you over a very long period of time, you are connecting with your soul family, and you are trying to relive that particular aspect of that lifestyle and that life, that way of life. So if you're showing George Bush, then it's not the shape-shifting that's wrong, it's George Bush that's wrong. It's his choice to do evil that is wrong, not the fact that he can shape-shift. So I wish people would understand the difference, that it's not shape-shifting is not wrong, it's your intention. What is your intention? So reptilian, right, person with a reptile soul is not evil. It's not what you are, it's what you choose to be. Right. You could be the most wonderful person in the world in terms of, you could have a lovely human soul in terms of, that's not alien, that's a human soul. You might be a horrible person. So people judge. That's what humans do. They judge, and they shouldn't do it till they've got all the facts. And the human race runs to make a judgment before it's got all the facts. And that's one problem of an early race. I look on the human race as children. Mm-hmm. They're the children who have grown up too quickly. Mm-hmm. They have outstripped their spiritual speed. They are unguided, and they are running amok, basically. But that's what they have to do. They have to learn, and they're either going to fall down or get themselves up. We have said they're going to get themselves up. But people need to understand that it is better to take 5 seconds, 10 seconds, and think than just say something which actually is offensive. And that's what humans do. They don't think, they act. And then they go away and they think better of it, and they come back and apologize. But they never learn. And this is what's got to happen. The human race has got to grow up. It's got to grow up, and it's got 2 years to grow up in, Alfred.
Yes, weighty thoughts. One final question.
Sure.
If I might, to get your reflections on this exopolitical situation. As you know, a number of whistleblowers have come forward on the secret U.S. Mars program. Mm-hmm. And notable among them are two, Andrew D. Bashago, who was a lieutenant commander in the secret CIA Mars program, also earlier in the Project Pegasus, the DARPA CIA time travel program. He went to Mars multiple times, teleporting in the Mars jump room, along with a number of other whistleblowers who mainly to the equatorial latitudes, which is where principally the Martian human races are, and various Earth human colonies are, and the U.S. Civilian human settlements. And there you have Andy Bashago, Bernard Mendez, William Stillings, and Michael Relf, and Arthur Neumann, a scientist, all of whom have come forward as whistleblowers, as having been to that sector. Then U.S. Marine Captain Randy Kramer has come public. He's now been interviewed by my colleague, Dr. Michael Sala, the Exopolitics Institute, by Carrie Cassidy, who you know as well. And he was a member for 17 years of the Mars Defense Force, which were deployed at the polar regions, mainly at the North Pole, which are controlled by the reptilian and mantid forces. These are intelligent reptilian and mantid forces that are indigenous to Mars and also have a component of Draco reptilians there.
Yes.
And the two forces are antagonistic to each other. The humans at the equatorial and the reptilian and mantid forces at the poles, the Mars Defense Force, which is U.S. Marines, in one action, they were ordered to go and retrieve some artifact in the mantid area, and out of 1,000 Marines that were ordered to do so, only 100 survived.
Mm-hmm.
And they all, and because these reptilian mantid beings are superior in size, the reptilians are about 8 or 9 feet, they have 2 hearts, and the mantid beings are similarly, you know, endowed, they're 7 or 8 feet. All of the humans have what I would call RoboCop suits, these suits that amplify their capabilities.
Yes.
And so Randy has now come back, and he's been authorized by his chain of command to go public, which he's doing. They also authorized him under a secret marine law that when less than 50% of the constitutional guarantees of the United States are operational, they can authorize someone to go public to state that.
Yes.
So he's done that. And he and I and Andy Bishago and Lauren Eisenhower have been on a public panel in which we've discussed these issues. Now, my question to you as a public official and also as an exopolitical actor of some note is, what do you make of this battle over Mars between the between the mantid community, who you know, the reptilian community, you know, the human community? Is it kind of a reflection of the NATO mentality that we have here on Earth that creates ISIS to create World War III, to try and create World War III, and they sort of exported that to Mars? Is that what's going on there?
How much time have we got left?
We have as much time as you wish.
Okay, because that cannot be answered very simply.
Mm-hmm.
On the first count, the mantid race and the reptilian race did make agreements a very long time ago in terms of the resourcing and manipulation of mankind, bottom line. However, the mantid race has a different agenda, and we see a divergence now between the reptilian race and the mantid race. However, if you are allocated a piece of real estate, you will defend that real estate. If you have items of value on that real estate and somebody comes along and tries to take them, you will defend them. But that should not be seen as necessarily supporting a reptilian agenda. It should be seen as defending the area and the items that you have on there. I have seen the suits, I've seen the soldiers that you describe. When you go through any form of portal or airlock, there is no air. But when you go through a jump to another planet, there is no air in that, and you can't take anything metal through. The suits look, the helmets look like, I don't know what you call them in Canada or America, like crash helmets, bicycle, motorbike helmets. And there's, in the primitive, the first generation, there was a tube probably about 6 inches long, which they had to learn to put down their throats, and they would automatically, the reflex would be to be sick, but they had to learn that. And the amount of oxygen in that tube was enough to get them through, which is only maybe 2 seconds, 3 seconds from one portal to the next. What I haven't told you, that sole agreement that I made in 1971, I agreed to have my soul taken from my body and placed in a mantis body, and for one of their souls to be placed in my body. And I have some very interesting memories of being in their culture and undertaking certain tasks. I have actually, for what it's worth, reviewed, in a military sense, a group of humans who are exactly as you described. And I'll just describe the weapon. And if you know anybody, please run this past them and see how they feel about it. I don't know if laser rifle is the right word. I'm talking about a rifle they have, which is an energy weapon, has no trigger. What you do is you hold a stock and you think fire and you squeeze it, and there's DNA, it happens very quickly. So there should be no trigger on these weapons, no, as we understand it. No sight either, no ranging sight. A device on the top which works by the traffic light system. Green, full power. Amber, we're running out of power here. Red, you've probably only got 6 or 7 shots left. So short range weapons. Weapons that are not designed for long-range fighting, and humans are used for close-quarter combat. Just to finish off, it's not really about the reptiles being 8 feet tall or the mantis being 8 feet tall. You will very rarely see a mantis or a reptile with a weapon. They use their minds. The greys will use weapons. The small greys will have energy beam weapons. A reptile or a mantid can kill a human psychically. It doesn't need an energy beam weapon to kill a human. That's why countless genuine contactee reports never show any alien with a weapon. The only weapon they will have is the wand or the rod, which is about 18 inches long, and is a device to switch a human off if there's a tricky situation. And that fires a blue light, which, when humans were being altered, dumbed down after the fall of Atlantis, there's a thing placed in all humans. So when the blue light frequency is fired at them, they just completely switch off. Mm-hmm. So they don't need weapons. They will use psychic. A reptile is between 7 to 8 times the strength of a human and can just rip a human apart. Literally, I've seen them rip people's heads off. That's fairly common. You can just pull their arms off. That's just the way they are. Mantids don't do that. Mantids will use less lethal force unless somebody has, has come onto their territory. Like a home invasion. I'm trying to think of a North American term. So the mantis would have seen those Marines as a home invasion, and they would then have been severely hit. The question for me is, what on earth is going on at the senior level of the Marine Corps? Because regardless of what anybody says, there is a command pattern that would link the mantids with the humans. And I think something underhand has gone on. I think there's been a rogue operation, we often get that, where something is not authorized officially, but is authorized unofficially. And it's a big political game that is being played out, because it doesn't create a war. It's a one-off battle, which is seen as, in the greater context, as Clausewitz, the German tactician, said, it's one battle, and you win it, you lose it, but that doesn't create a bigger war, because it's part of the game played out. So yes, absolutely. The bases are called Adam and Eve. There's one on the moon and one on the Mars, and they're called Adam and Eve. They were built by the small greys originally, and then reactivated them for humankind. The reptiles really didn't like that. That caused a conflict, particularly on the moon, but on Mars as well. And now the humans they've been segregated, in the sense that they have a portion that they can operate on, but they have to be within the elite. So you couldn't have your normal Apollo missions, because they're not authorized. It would be a special group, a special team. So what you've described to me, I absolutely agree with, seen it myself. They're speaking the truth, and well done for them for being brave enough and putting the human race above their own safety. So well done to them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Simon, would you be open to being on a kind of a roundtable discussion with Captain Randy Kramer, who spent 17 years on Mars, dealing with mainly the Mantid and Reptilian forces, and who's gotten to know the Mantids very well in a different context? Because
I would be. You'd have to tell him that he has nothing to fear from me, because if you have researched me, you will know that I'm very connected to the Mantids.
Yes.
However, my loyalty, that's why I'm here on this planet, my loyalty is to the human race. So I would be very happy to meet him. And it would be a privilege, actually, to meet a human who is accepted as a messenger. I can't think of I'm trying to think of a word in human terms. He would be acceptable to the Mantids, and it would be a great privilege for me, as somebody who has inhabited both bodies, and he probably won't find that too crazy. Yes, I would love to have a chat with him. That would be nice.
Yeah. Well, I'm not sure that he would has been accepted by the Mantids. He spent 17 years as part of the Mars Defense Force in the polar regions.
But he's not dead, Alfred.
I'm sorry?
He's not dead.
Oh yeah, no. He's not dead.
He's seen as part of the game, the big chess game.
I see.
He's seen as part of the chess game. In other words, they don't see him. It's his job.
Yeah.
As an individual, they probably have a great deal of respect for him.
I see. Yes.
It's the fact that who his employer is.
Yes.
But he will have had telepathic communication from the Mantids. That's part. Even without you telling me, I know that what will happen.
Okay.
And that's what I meant by he'll be accepted, because if he's had telepathic communication, they are opening a channel with him for debate, dialogue.
Good.
That's good. That's what we do.
Yes. Well, good. I'll arrange a time probably. Later on in either November or December of this year, perhaps.
Sure.
And I'm looking forward very much to that roundtable, because I think that we all can learn a great deal. Now is an extraordinary time where the U.S. and British and some extent Russian international presence on Mars is becoming known, and our planetary separation for more than 11,500 years is finally over.
Yes.
So good. Well, I promised only to keep you for 60 minutes, and we've gone considerably over that, and I certainly want to thank you for having taken time out now. Are there any words that you'd like to leave our viewers with at this crucial time? We're in October of 2014. We're entering this crucial 2014, 2015, 2016 time period.
Yes, Alfred, don't take any inoculations against Ebola.
Oh, profound words. Well, thank you. Thank you very much. I want to thank you for being with us today and taking time out of your schedule. And we look forward to being with you again. Notably, when you're with us in a roundtable with U.S. Marine Captain Randy Kramer, a 17-year veteran with the Mantids and the Reptilians on Mars. Counselor?
I'm looking forward to that. Thank you.
Oh, good. Counselor Simon Parks, thank you very much.
It's a pleasure. Thank you, Alfred. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Thank you.